It's been interesting sort of watching and listening as an observer today in terms of trying to assess where we're at. We've got four very distinguished people here. Everyone who now is involved in a university, which is quite a strange. Are you officially an academic?
Well, yeah, kind of.
So I'll introduce my panel and then we'll get into our questions. I'll start at the top. Professor Kevin Morgan, who was chair of Yes for Wales back in 97. And you're still teaching, I believe, and still Dean of Engagement, is that correct? Cardiff University. Professor Laura McAllister, who's now at Cardiff University. For much of my time when I was in the BBC, she used to be Liverpool University. And public policy and, what is it, Laura, sorry?
Governance in Wales, yeah.
Dr. Axel Kaner, yes. I've got that right, hopefully.
Yes, you did.
Also ex-Cardiff University, but now Edge Hill, is that right?
Yes, that's correct, yeah.
And Helen Marion Jones, who I knew very well from her days in Plaid Cymru and in the Assembly as a Plaid Cymru AM, but now at the Morgan Academy at Swansea University. So thank you all for being here. We've got a big question, which I suppose is probably the biggest question for the public, and it always is when it comes to devolution in general, but were the promises of 97 delivered? And I think before we start asking about whether or not they were delivered, can I ask you, Kevin, just remind us of what were the promises of that manifesto of sort for Yes for Wales of 97?
I'm looking at Leighton here to see if my memory is working right. From memory, I think that the two fundamental goals, aspirations, promises, were one was a political one and one was social, economic. On the political side, I'd say we promised or we aspired to render Wales a more democratic nation. As Leighton and others have said this morning, it's difficult now to really recall the situation that Wales was in, the kind of ignominious situation we were in. We were a quango state run by quangos. And I was one of those people who argued that when Wales is a more mature country, we'll raise a statue in the Assembly to John Redwood, because we could never have done it without his. let's put it this way: his inadvertent assistance. So politically, and Laura can say a lot more about this than me. I think we have realised that goal. It's work in progress, but we are a much more democratic nation than we were. Economically, I'll say more about this in a moment. That's been an enormous disappointment, and the biggest single disappointment of all, and for me, and the question is, why is that? So I'll just leave it at that for the moment.
Laura, in many ways, are any promises from 20 years ago able to be assessed 20 years later, particularly political ones?
Well, it's appropriate to do so, I think, but I think Kevin's right. The new kind of politics that was promised was pretty visionary, really, and I mean, Helen was involved with the National Assembly Advisory Group, and that sort of translation of what came out of the white paper into what we were hoping to have in the first democratically elected assembly was always going to be a big ask. I think, again, perhaps I'm not as generous as Kevin's been, in that I think some of the themes of the National Assembly Advisory Group did translate themselves into action in the assembly, some didn't. For me, the most important thing that didn't happen was a more pluralist acceptance, the challenge and disagreement and dissonance was a good thing. It was interesting to hear the two presiding officers talking then about their interpretations of how things were managed in the chamber, but I think deep down we still haven't made a sufficient change in our political culture to make pluralism really materialise in any meaningful way. Other things have, in fairness. You know, there's no doubt that despite several of us criticising some Welsh Government decisions around transparency, there has been greater transparency in terms of how government operates. And as Eileen Jones said, there's been greater representativeness. But I don't think there's been sufficient buy-in on a really kind of serious acceptance of what pluralism is all about, and that remains for me the biggest weakness.
Axel, there was obviously a big push in 97 to get politics closer to the people. Do you think, in a sense, particularly in key policy areas such as health, that level of government is now close to the people, or do people know it's that close to them?
Yeah, interesting enough, I put that down when I thought about, you know, what's actually the assessment, what should the assessment be of the 20 years assembly work. I put down, there was a vague promise, and I know the loaded some terminology in there, there was a vague promise that political decision making would be closer to the people. And thinking critically about this, I wonder really whether we achieved that in a sense. I certainly, when I came to, you can hear this in my accent, I'm not from Wales, and when I came in 1996 to the UK, and in fact to South Wales, the following year there was a huge relief. I mean, there was an enormous upswing of political activity around the sort of elections in 1997, etc., and the new Blair government. And I wonder whether, if you really wanted to assess the Welsh Assembly in the last 20 years, we also have to put it into the historical context of 1997. And that's sort of like relief of, you know, there was a huge political transformation in the country. And before that sort of backdrop, I'm not so sure that the many things, good things that happened here in Wales wouldn't have happened anyway. Because to a certain extent, The years 1997 to 2007 were also years of economic prosperity, an enormous change and transformation in the country, positive transformation, really progressive transformation. And whilst there clearly are some things that the Welsh Assembly did, I wonder whether some of the improvements in health, in social care, the enormous investment, for example, in NHS, wouldn't have happened anyway. So I just want to sort of like, you know, compare and contrast this a bit. I know it's contrafactual, it's very difficult to say what would have happened. But I think it's important to ask that question if we are looking back over the last 20 years and saying, well, it was the Welsh Assembly who did that. I'm not so sure. And we probably come to, in our discussion, to a couple of detailed points about this.
And in that sense, then, one of the things was about having people more representative of Wales, governing Wales and legislating for Wales. Has that happened?
To a certain extent, it definitely did. I think, you know, we talked a lot today about having to remember where we come from, and I come to this discussion as a survivor of the 1979 referendum campaign and the wound that did committed on the psyche of the people of Wales, and Wales's politics is not to be forgotten. Many of us in 1997 knew that what was being offered was cautious, it was limited, it was about what was deliverable. It didn't, you know, there were, as I think David Thomas mentioned earlier, you know, the real discussions with Plaid Cymru about whether we ought to support that settlement because it was so cautious. But most of us believed we needed to make that step. It is absolutely clear that having governance from Cardiff is closer to the people of Wales than having governance from Westminster, but it's also, for me, about a political culture. I mean, I think I can tell you something of what might have happened between 1997 and 2011, because historically, Labour governments have been just as likely to ignore the needs and wishes of the people of Wales, I'm afraid, as Conservative ones. So would some of those progressive things have happened? I'm sure that some of them would. Some of the positive things, some of the mistakes that Labour government made, governments in Wales avoided. We didn't go down the PPI route in half the extent, so we haven't hocked our public sector infrastructure for future generations. In terms of the representation of women, the first assembly was groundbreaking, and it's already been mentioned that took real political courage in the Labour Party and in Plaid Cymru to make that happen because it was very controversial. Of course, that hasn't been sustained, and we're seeing that beginning to slip back. I certainly would not, as a single parent of a three-year-old child, be able to stand for assembly election now, because the assembly now, coming back to the National Assembly Advisory Group, regularly sits very late at night, and unless you can afford expensive childcare, well, basically unless you can afford a nanny who lives in, if you haven't got a partner or a husband or a wife who's supporting your childcare, you can't do that. So there are some ways in which we've slipped back. But in terms of the original question of the panel, you know, did the referendum deliver on its promise? Well, for me, the one promise, there were lots of other aspirations, there were lots of other hopes around it, but the one promise was that decisions affecting people in Wales would for the first time be made in Wales. That has been achieved. There's a very different set of discussions to be had about Has it been fully achieved? Could it have been done better? I'm sure we'll come back to talk about the economy, which I think is the biggest failure, because so many other things fall out of the economy. If you have a successful economy, there are all sorts of things you can do that you can't do without a successful economy. But there are undoubtedly aspects of life in Wales that are better for some people than they would have been if we had not had devolution. And particularly, and this, of course, was the argument for many people, I think, within Labour that convinced them after the 80s, was that we could never go into the phase where Wales was completely vulnerable to a ruthless Conservative government ever again. We could also have a debate about how effective successive Welsh governments have been about defending Wales from that, but it certainly is not half as bad as it would have been had we been left to Cameron and May with nobody to defend us.
Okay. Kevin, if we can move to the economy, because we're in that stage, and obviously it's a lot of your background. The promises in the economy are always very difficult, particularly in the wake of a general election in 97. Were there specific... Was there a specific belief around the economy, do you think, that hasn't been achieved?
Well, let's put it this way. There's a big debate about this. I've been engaged for many years with the Welsh government's chief economist about this. He makes a very credible argument that since the millennium, Wales has held its own against the UK trends. You know, if you look at long-term growth rates, GDP per capita, it's been a fairly straightish line compared to the rest of the UK. That's what his argument is. I was much more ambitious. As Ron Davis was, Ron Davis spoke about creating what he called an economic powerhouse that would design a step change in our performance. I mean, that's the kind of ambition that I was looking for, and what many people in Wales was looking for. What have we had since then? We've not had a step change. The fact that West Wales and the Valleys continues to be classified as, quote, a less developed region. And by the way, it's the only less developed region in the whole of the United Kingdom that was a less developed region in the 1930s. Yes, there's a bit of Cornwall that qualifies, but the fact that West Wales and the Valleys is still the only less developed region in the UK is an index, to my mind, of a colossal collective developmental failure. That's not attributing blame to this or that party. It's a collective failure in which my own sector, the university sector, is culpable. So when we compare ourselves to industrial regions that have transformed themselves, I do a lot of work in the Basque Country. The Basques have clearly used their powers to transform their economy. We haven't done that. The question is why is that? And I personally think, and I agree with people like Jerry Holton and others, that the reasons are non-economic, that the reasons go to cultural, institutional reasons. Today, we've heard a lot about powers, understandably so, what powers are being devolved. But we haven't heard hardly anything about capacities. To assume a new power is one thing, but to have the capacity, the competence and confidence to deploy it effectively is something completely different. And that's where we really fall behind places like the Basque Country, it seems to me.
Laura, have we seen a kind of lack of ideas over the last 20 years, particularly given what's happened?
No, I don't. I mean, I agree with Kevin. I don't think we've seen a lack of ideas. I think we've seen plenty of ideas, actually. What we've seen more of is a lack of the joining up of a good intention with the ability to deliver it. And I think this is a really significant issue. In some respects, the establishment of the Assembly went ahead the rest of Welsh society. We just didn't have a strong enough civic society. We didn't have a strong enough distinct private sector to be able to offer some contribution to that. Although I have to say, I'm not sure that at times whether the Welsh Government would have welcomed the input from the private sector in a way it should have. But that's a separate issue. I think we've had no shortage of great schemes, of big ideas and missions, but we've almost willed them to be delivered rather than put in place the stages by which they can be delivered. And this is effectively what Kevin's saying. And I think this isn't an attack on the Welsh government, because all of the parties have been complicit in that, as have other external institutions like the university. So we've all got to hold our hands up. We've all got a little bit too carried away with the end rather than actually putting in place the means by which we could achieve that end. And that's not just in the economy either. I think that's in other sectors.
Axel, in health, do you think in a sense we've been too conservative with a small C rather than being conservative with a big C?
I think there are actually two things that are very, very closely related. And I think that sort of like I take you up on one of the points you made earlier on, and that is, first of all, democratic accountability and participation and involvement of people in Wales. And the other thing is quality of the services delivered. And they actually hang together. And I do have to take issue with the fact, with the argument that, you know, by dint of being in Cardiff, the government is closer to the people. I just don't see that argument. I know when you look at evidence is very limited anyway, because we don't do good research around this, but actually little research we've done, the consultations that are run by Cardiff government, as well as by the civil service here in Cardiff, have been relatively poor in quality in terms of participation. They've been very, very poor levels of involvement of people of Wales in this. And that makes for very, very poor sort of like senses of stakes as well, of a stakeholder society. And of course it relates to what Laura said, is a very, very weak civil society to a certain extent. So in a sense, I'm just not convinced that people in Llandudno, for people in Llandudno, Cardiff is closer than London sometimes. I just don't see that. And I also don't see it in specific areas. If we really want to measure what did the Assembly delivered in the last 20 years, we really need to go to the very tricky elements, those that would probably have to be delivered in conjunction and collaboration with Westminster and others. For example, transport. What has, as a critical friend, what really has changed in terms of public transport from the Valleys to Cardiff? I mean, it is shocking. It is hideous. It is not worthy of Wales, what is still being delivered. And that's one of the things. I mean, I completely agree. It wasn't in the powers of the Welsh government at certain points. But these are the things that really should have moved, and they haven't. And the question is, why not?
Helen, was the offer too weak in 97?
I think because the offer was as weak as it was, there has been an inevitable engagement in political society in Wales
to be thinking about the powers we have to do things rather than what we're doing with the powers. And I don't think that's... I'm not blaming Welsh Government for that, because that would be true across party in the Assembly. I think it would also be true in very often in civil society. It's certainly true in academia. We've done a lot to study how Wales is governed. We perhaps all need to do more now about studying, you know, what has worked, what hasn't worked, what else could have been done. The powers did need to be strengthened. I think, you know, history will tell us how much of a distraction that was. But I do think we, in this discussion, need to make a difference between what successive governments have done or not done and what the institution itself. And I think that's very important. And the figures that Roger showed us earlier today show that the people of Wales are actually really very good at doing that, because they might be critical of the governments, successive governments, around different policy areas, but they still want those decisions made here. And one way in which we can measure whether they feel that the Assembly as an institution is closer to them than Westminster is the figures that, again, Roger showed us about where people think decisions ought to be made, and they, on the whole, think decisions ought to be made in Wales. Another piece of research, which I saw a little while ago, and this may be slightly out of date now, but when I saw that, people in Wales, including in Llandudno, were about five times more likely to know the name of their National Assembly member than they were to know the name of their MP. Now, I think that's indicative of a closeness, because closeness isn't just about sitting in the legislature and legislating. One of the big differences, and again, I think I'm in an interesting position here because I've been a member of the National Assembly. I've also tried to be a regional assembly member for Mid and West Wales, and I'm inclined to agree with David Ellis-Thomas that that's incredibly difficult to do, trying to represent that range of communities. You spend an awful lot of time on the A470, as I'm sure regional members do now. But I've also then been out of that and been in a position of trying to influence government and influence the Assembly, and very much involving and engaging young people in that process. And one of the positives, I think, is that Assembly members, on the whole, are much more visible in their communities than MPs are. That may be partly because about two-thirds of them, I think, go home every night. You know, they're going back to the communities that on the whole elected them. And that's positive. But has as much been done with those powers as ought to have been done? Well, no, not by any manner of means. And I think there are reasons for that. I think there's a timidity. I think successive assembly governments, and again, this isn't a party political point, have failed to take out and take down local government where it needed to be tackled, and failed either to say, this is your responsibility, you sort it out and you carry the can when it goes wrong, or to say, no, you clearly can't do this and you need to take those powers centrally. And I'll give a very small example of that. My previous role was running a youth work charity. Now, people in England used to say to us, you're so lucky, your government pours millions of pounds a year into youth work in Wales. And we'd go, yes, but it does that through the local authorities. The local authorities can then spend it on what they like. Only 5 out of the 22 of them actually spent it on youth work. So you as a lobbyist were in a catch-22 because the government was saying, we're giving all this money to youth work, but it wasn't coming out the other end. So you couldn't get them for it. I mean, one of the other things that I see as sort of culturally a bit dangerous is our National Addiction Commissioners. The Children's Commissioner I would make an exception for because children can't vote. And the Children's Commissioner is there to be in their voice in political community. I agree with the point that I think Jack made earlier that it should almost certainly be a responsibility of the Assembly. But an older person's commissioner? An older person's commissioner, when older people are substantially more likely to vote than anybody else does, and policies, therefore, certainly at a Westminster level, are substantially made for them. Now, we have the older person's commissioner, and he or she could make representations to the government about the parlous state of the interface between health and social care, and the government don't have to do anything about it. Again, with the Welsh Language Commissioner, you appoint an independent commissioner, she tells you what you ought to do, and you don't do it. No comeback. And as for what's going to happen with the Future Generations Commissioner, well, the proof of the pudding will be in the M4 corridor. But the point being, apart from, you know, taking the mick a little bit, is that there's a step back from responsibility there. And Kevin talked about needing to move away from the quango culture. I worry a little bit that if we're not careful, we're replacing nasty quangos full of white upper-middle-class businessmen with nice, cuddly commissioners. But the lack of accountability is still the same.
Kevin, in terms of delivery then, OK, we've had 20 years. In some ways, you can get away with saying this was the bedding down. You know, one generation has had devolution. What would you like to see change in terms of delivery over the next 10 to 15 years, whoever makes up the government here?
Well, I think it goes back to the root problem that we've had over the last 20 years, creating a government and a public sector initially, which has the competence and confidence to deploy the powers that it's got to better effect. I mean, let me just give you one example, because you've got to talk about real examples. If you talk about the realm, I realise it's quote, a very non-sexy realm, but it's enormously important. The whole realm of public procurement.
Yeah.
You know, governments have 3 powers in their toolbox, don't they? They have the power to tax, the power to regulate, and the power of purchase. And that third power, for various reasons, has been the most neglected power of all. I go so far as to say, public procurement gives you the biggest example of a developmental failure over the last 20 years, and that was the failure to scrutinise the rail franchise. Mm. Now, the fact that that Whitehall could design a rail franchise over all those number of years and factoring in zero growth was little short of a scandal. And any government worth its salt would have scrutinised that assumption, because out of that assumption flows all the problems we've had with overcrowding of rolling stock and all the rest of it. And yet public procurement is also one of our best stories. When Leighton was a minister, they brought in civil society people within government in a little unit called Eye to Eye, Innovate to Inform, or something like this, Leighton was called. And they designed a radical new procurement policy called the Can-Do Toolkit, to show public bodies how to procure and to design contracts with community benefit clauses. That was one of the most innovative things ever done in the United Kingdom public sector, but it never spilled over outside of the social housing sector. So, for example, in the sector that I looked at mainly, food, school food, you had the best council and the worst council in Wales, cheek by jowl. Why didn't that knowledge spill over? Mm. Why didn't Welsh Government, in a sense, disseminate good practice from one area to another? Why didn't the Welsh Local Government Association? You've got to look, this is what the Basques do well. They identify good practice and they make sure it's disseminated across the sector. I would say that's been one of the biggest problems of all in Wales over the last 20 years. And in the context of Brexit, when we'll have an enormous capacity problem to design and deliver policies, the fact that we've got over 400 civil servants in Welsh Government today dependent on European structural funds for core functions, for core posts. There's no public awareness of this, of what the opportunity costs of Brexit will be in Wales in terms of the capacity to design and deliver policies. And I would say, you know, putting it concretely, that's the biggest challenge we have in Wales, to use our powers effectively, whatever those powers are.
So Laura, moving on to the second part of the session then, in terms of that challenge, what specific government challenges lie ahead? Brexit being one, we have a new Wales Act, which has conferred certain powers. Yeah. We've got an EU withdrawal bill going through Parliament now.
Brexit, clearly, you know, the overwhelming one, the predominant one, the one that will shape everything. And, you know, a lot's been said already about how that will recast relationships between not just the government here and Westminster and Whitehall, but also between the governments of these Isles. I think the arrangements between the DUP and the Conservatives make that difficult, to say the least, because there was the possibility that the devolved administrations, albeit with very different colour governments, could have had some kind of united front over areas of repatriation of competences. But I think that the DUP situation has made that incredibly difficult. I think in terms of the authority that comes to Wales now through the Wales Act, the Llywydd referred to some possibilities there. Let me just take that one issue of capacity within the Assembly. Now, I appreciate this isn't a sexy issue. It isn't an issue that, again, is going to make people out there embrace devolution any better, although it might in the longer term, because what Kevin was referring to there was where the scrutiny deficit creates problems in terms of policy delivery. And if you look at this, the institution that we have, that it simply isn't fit for purpose. It cannot be fit for purpose when Assembly members are serving on so many committees simultaneously that they have to try to be on top of the huge committee workload. Forget the other activities that go on. It isn't all about what they do when they're in that building, but the committee workload is hugely significant. And the reality is it's massively different to Westminster. In Westminster, you know, there's around 120 MPs who have no role other than to represent their constituencies. In Wales, that just simply isn't the case for the 40-odd members that are trying to scrutinise these really difficult policy things that come in front of them from the Welsh Government. And that surely is the only way that we can tackle some of the poor policy delivery that we have. Because the currency of scrutiny, it's, for me, it's very simple. There are two bits of currency to scrutiny. Time, because you've got to have time to scrutinise properly, and knowledge, expertise and approach. And those two things go together. And at the moment, we just simply do not have the numbers of Assembly members to be able to discharge that role significantly.
Axel, is there the expertise out there bringing in new ideas for the next 20 years in heritage as health?
There certainly is expertise and there's innovative capacity, etc., and all this. What is really missing, and I think that echoes a point Kevin made, is the institutions, organisations that support shared learning. And by the way, that doesn't just go for Wales. The great advantage of devolution is that you do things differently. And when you do things differently, you compare and contrast and you actually learn from each other. As far as we've done, you know, some research around, as far as we understand it, there isn't really much on the side of health. NHS now has basically expanded into four constituent parts. But there isn't really much in terms of shared learning platforms and shared learning arenas for the NHS or for social care, for that matter, across the UK. And that's a real, real miss. It's a real lack of opportunity here. You know, we can really use this, but we are not using this at the moment. And I have to say also in terms of social care is enormous, especially funding for elderly people, is an enormous issue. And there has been practically, for various reasons, practically a zero of real good positive debate about how to tackle social care funding for elderly people. And we all remember the disaster in the election campaign, in the electoral campaign, of course. So we really, really need not just the ideas; we also need the platforms and arenas where we can share our learning and our experiences. And one of the things that's very important is devolution shouldn't just work for the people of Wales. Whereas devolution should work for all of us, and that's one of the areas, shared learning, where we really can benefit all of us together.
And do you think, as a people, we haven't quite grasped devolution?
Well, I think, some of the statistics that Roger was showing us this morning, we have grasped it to a certain extent. We've embraced it, you know, and I think I was very struck by how fast the opposition fell off. I would have expected to see that to be much more gradual and perhaps more up and down in the lines with people's perceptions of how governments were doing. But I think we've got a long way to go, and I think, you know, some of the themes that other people have touched on, I don't think Wales has been short of ideas, and I don't think the Welsh Government has been short, in many cases, of picking them up and being ready to run with them. But it seems to me, and I should at this stage say that I'm speaking for myself, not for the political party of which I'm a member, nor for the academic institute of which I'm a deputy director, because I've only been there a fortnight and I don't want to get sacked yet. But it seems to me that there's a lack of willingness somewhere in Welsh Government, and certainly in my experience it's very varied between ministers, about when we know what works, about driving that through. I agree with what Kevin has said. I mean, you know, there is never going to be sufficient capacity inside the Welsh Civil Service to develop the new ideas, and there shouldn't need to be, but there has to be a willingness within the Welsh Civil Service to pick up those ideas and use them. And there has to be a willingness amongst Welsh ministers, scrutinised by the Assembly, to say, we know this works, we also know you've been doing it that way in that health board for however long you've been doing it, and it doesn't work, and you've got to stop, and there'll be consequences if you don't stop, and chief executives will have their performance-related pay affected, and people will be sacked if they have to be. And I think it's this, if we're thinking about what's needed next, is for some of those really positive ideas and some of the good things that have been begun. I mean, I cite the early years curriculum. You know, we've actually done revolutionary things in Wales with that, but then, you know, the PISA figures hit and we panic and we start shoving kids into doing tests that just make them miserable again. So we've got to have a bit of the courage of our own. I know Leighton wouldn't agree with me about that, but, you know, I on this, I know I'm right. Not about many things, but on this, I know I'm right. But I really think that it's that if one thing has got to change, it's that ability, perhaps, to be a little bit nastier sometimes, if we have to be.
Kevin.
Excepting Leighton from that, of course, who was always nasty as was necessary.
I would say, if it's summarising, you know, where we've been and where we need to go, which is accelerated by Brexit, it seems to me, we need to grasp this nettle of capacity. How do we in Wales, you know, make that transition from good intentions to good practice? Because that's the key weakness, running right through many policies. My own field is economic development. And one of the ways to address this capacity deficit internally in Welsh Government, in the Assembly, is to reach out, not just to civil society and business, but also to the university sector. I agreed a lot with what Cathy said this morning, but I can't let her get away with an outrageous thing she said when she said that the universities in Wales haven't got devolution because they're happily going away advising Swedish governments and not the Welsh government. Can I just say that governmental advice is a demand-driven thing. It's not a supply-driven thing. Academics respond to invitations, to requests. This is why I spend more time working in the Basque Country than I do in Wales. And my colleagues spend time in other European regions. It's they haven't been invited to distill their expertise for the sake of Wales. I think Welsh Government and National Assembly are really going to have to grasp this nettle about capacity. In the short term, maybe they won't increase their numbers. I believe they should. There's an intellectual case for increasing numbers, without a shadow of a doubt, in my view, if capacity is going to be redressed. But in the interim, and even beyond, there's a need to reach out, to embrace, and to work in concert with universities, civil society, business, to redress this deficit. Otherwise, we will never move, as I say, from this problem of moving from good intentions to good practice.
I think that's right, Kevin, but is it a question of capacity? I agree there is a question of capacity. Or is it a question of sometimes being ready to challenge vested interests? And those vested interests might be in all sorts of places. They might be in the structures of health boards. They might be in local government. They might be inside the civil service. So I don't disagree with you that...
They most certainly are. The argument I always had with Rodri over many, many years was this. Whenever we challenged Rodri, in the sense of constructive challenge, he would always say to us, stop talking Wales down. In other words, Rodri articulated one of the great problems in Welsh political culture, to my mind, which was that constructive challenge was always misconstrued as disloyalty. You can't move forward when you dismiss constructive challenge like that. I'm sorry.
This idea of Team Wales, we in journalism always hated that idea because we were supposed to be part of it as well.
Yeah.
Team Wales?
No, not really, only in sport, not in anything else. Couldn't agree more, by the way, with what you said, although I'd use slightly different language. I don't think it's about being nastier. I think it's just being a little bit more focused, being prepared to offend. And if anybody has a chance, read a book by somebody who nobody likes, Claire Fox from the Institute of Ideas, Moral Maze. Nobody likes her, but she's got some sensible points, like all kind of iconoclastic thinkers. And she talks about things like the ventriloquism of stakeholding. And that's really interesting concept, because you're effectively getting your stakeholders to tell you exactly what you want them to tell you so that you can do exactly what you want them to do. The problem we've had is a lot of that in Wales, and a lot of spreading the resources so thinly in order not to offend lots of groups out there who've got a vested interest in something else. We just need to be more focused and a bit tougher. Not nastier necessarily, just a bit tougher.
I'm a bit more cynical than Laura.
I'm going to open up to the floor in a minute. So, Axel?
Yeah, just
finish?
A brief point. And I think that links in with something we haven't talked about at all, and that's the challenge of populism. And we haven't really seen it yet here so much. I mean, in the chamber, maybe at some points. But the key challenge or the key critique of populism is that establishment is actually dominating the political debate. And having sort of listened to us over the last 2 hours here, it's the nature of the beast. We're talking about the assembly and we're all talking about the parliamentarian side of it. But this is really just one part of democracy. And we really need to bear that in mind. We need to step outside of that sometimes and ask ourselves, how do you deliver? Otherwise, we will not answer that challenge of populism.
Okay, we've got about 10, 15 minutes, so I'm keen to take questions and points. If you do make points, please tell us who you are and keep your points brief. Similarly, with the questions, open them out to the panel if you've got specific individuals. Start the front there. Over there?
My name is David Patrick. I spent the last 36 years living in Hong Kong, where capitalism reigns red in tooth and claw. My question is directed particularly at Professor Kevin Morgan, but also the other members. How can Wales be a fertile place in which to build the private sector, overseas investment, if at the same time as this, Caroline is inviting Wales to embrace the world, we're also at the same time encouraging a very much wider use of the Welsh language? And if I read clause 38 of the Welsh language bill, an obligation possibly to use the Welsh language in the service industries. Also, the senior minister talked about bringing in a separate Welsh jurisdiction. It seems to me that an increased use of the Welsh language in the private sector, together with the introduction of a separate legal jurisdiction for Wales, will actually do a great deal to blow the brains out of any prospective development. I don't know. I may be wrong. Maybe I've been living in Hong Kong too long.
Yes, you are. Kevin?
I think most multinational companies I've ever encountered are quite smart organisations, you know. They can keep two ideas in their heads at the same time. I've never been aware that the Welsh language is an impediment to anything. Or, well, can I, well, you asked me a question. Can I finish the answer?
Sorry.
Okay. I've never been aware personally of it being an impediment to business development, inward investment, or innovation. And from my experience in the university, some of the smartest talent that we have, particularly from Europe, speak multiple languages, you know? So we have multiple identities. And this, in a world of populism and intolerance and authoritarianism, the idea of the multiple identity, it seems to me, is something that's very precious and progressive to hold on to. So I have no experience, personally, of the threat that you perceive.
No, I'm not against the Welsh language, but if you're obliged in service industries in the private sector
I'm not aware of it being a problem.
Two of the most successful regions of European economy, the Basque Country and Catalonia, they all have much stronger language legislation around the promotion and use of their minority languages, and it certainly hasn't put off multinational companies from working there. It's a shibboleth.
Okay. Hello. David Cadog. I particularly wanted to ask Dr. Carner, because he works outside Wales, although having lived here before, a point that hasn't really been raised before. You were talking about some of the advantages of devolution ought to be different. It ought to reinforce and improve the delivery of services in all the home countries. And I just wondered whether he thought perhaps that the absence of a properly responsible English government, which is so easily confused and conflated with the British government, is a real problem. It seems to me that with more responsibility, there should also be more cooperation. And I think it's pretty shabby, I speak as an older person, that there has still not been worked out any bus scheme, you know, with the concessionary bus passes, because it's not Wales's problem, it's the fact that there isn't anybody to talk to in England. And I wonder if that perhaps affected health services or things like that.
Yeah. I think on the constitutional side, I defer to my colleagues, very distinguished colleagues here, who know this debate better, I mean, about English, English devolution, etc. But what I can say for health, there are enormous opportunities now, because the problem with devolution and research around devolution is very often that the units are not comparable. Wales is simply not, and Scotland is simply not comparable to England. We know that. It's a huge a problem in any research project and any study. But what we do have now is devolution, social and health, health and social care to Manchester and other areas. And actually, they're quite comparable. It's about 3 million people, you know, give and take, in Manchester, and not stepping on any toes, but about a similar size here, though far greater in landmass, of course. So there are real opportunities now with the ongoing devolution in the NHS in England, and to say, well, what's happening there? We've had some similar experiences here. What do we do? I work in integration. And one of the key lessons from integration in NHS services is what is integration to me is probably fragmentation to you. So there is no everybody wins. Very often there are losers as well. And devolution is a similar story. I mean, devolution for the NHS is probably looked at differently for somebody who lives in the border region or has a very ill child living in North Wales and then has to travel all the way to Cardiff to UHW instead of going to a hospital in Liverpool. So these are real significant issues and we need to discuss them. We can actually now compare them with other issues. So I think there are more opportunities as we move along and as devolution gathers pace in England as well.
Geraint?
Yeah, Geraint, just to raise a question of delivery and sort of two aspects that strike me. One, there has been no discussion so far about the nature of the civil service in Wales. We have had in Wales a sort of public service management initiative, and I wonder what the panel feels about that, because it strikes me that you know, sending people for a weekend at Llandrindod Wells, you know, or even to Bangor University or, you know, to Swansea is not the same thing as maybe developing a cadre of people who might be sent to INSEAD or to Harvard or, you know, even to London to actually develop the civil service in that way. Secondly, just say on the delivery issue, Kevin mentioned the quangos, and I know every time the word quangos comes up, the word itself has an immediate pejorative feeling, right? And I just wonder whether in terms of delivery, we have lost out by not actually retaining significant executive agencies that may actually be more transparent than civil service departments.
Two things then. Bonfire the Crown Goes, which some of us will remember well, and then the idea of a Welsh civil service, which I think Andrew Davies used to talk about when he was economy minister. Have we achieved a Welsh civil service, and should we reconsider the idea of non-executive organisations?
Well, on the first question, I mean, there's no doubt that we're aware of the shortcomings in terms of scale, in terms of confidence, and in terms of centres of expertise, that we're not where we need to be in Wales, without a shadow of doubt. There's unevenness within the Welsh Civil Service, but as a general rule, we are really not where we need to be in terms of the capacity to design, deliver, and project manage. And look at Transport for Wales. That's where we should be looking to monitor the biggest ever procurement project in Welsh history as they design the metro project. Do we have the skill sets to manage that? I hope we do. I fear we don't. So we need to do something pretty drastic, it seems to me. Welsh government itself hasn't helped, because you know what, you know, the famous Gerry Holtham critique of Welsh government was that each ministerial portfolio was a fiefdom, sufficient unto itself. And under one economic minister, for example, not only could Hugh Edwards not get an interview for 3 years, but civil servants in that department were forbidden to talk to another civil servant outside of that department. I had many clandestine discussions with those people, you know, where we all had to wear balaclavas the notion of joined up government, you know, was anathema from that point of view. So we need to learn those lessons, be honest about them to move forward. That's on the first question. And very quickly on the second, you know, I was a well-known defender of the Welsh Development Agency. For all its warts, and there are many problems, I didn't think those problems merited abolition. It merited reform, but we needed an arm's length agency that was less risk averse than the civil service. I don't know a single region in the European Union that's done the same as us. And I can't believe that Wales is ahead of the curve in terms of abolishing that competence. That's not a popular view in the Labour group in the Welsh Assembly. I'm aware of that. But I will defend the right of an arm's length expert quango, if you will.
Helen Mary, we should be getting rid of commissioners. Should we actually be bringing some quangos back?
Well, I think it's a question about how you make best use of expertise. And, you know, by the time we came to the bonfire of the quangos, the truth is that WDA, as it was politically toxic. There were an awful lot of people who'd been very unhappy with the way certain things were driven through. They were seen, and I'm only saying seen, I'm not saying this is true, but they were seen as unaccountable, unresponsive to communities, only interested in massive, great, big projects, not interested in growing smaller stuff. So clearly the WDA was going to need to change. I think the aspiration was that expertise would be taken in-house, that decisions would still be made and that some of them would be risky decisions, and because if you're investing in the economy, you know, there's no 100%. I think that got lost, if we're honest. And I think we need to now think again about how best to make use of that expertise. I mean, there is also a thing about when you've got elected ministers, the people making the decisions ought to be the people that the people can sack. I mean, that, of course, was the idea around getting rid of the market mechanisms in health and introducing the local health boards. Unfortunately, to me, what's happened with that is that instead of the then minister, who would stand up and say, yes, that's my responsibility around a health decision, you now get ministers saying, oh, this is the responsibility of that health board, and they're actually arguably less accountable than they were before. So I think it's time for a rethink, but I also think it's important we're not romantic about the old quangos either. And just to briefly touch on the point about the civil service, it's clearly become more difficult. And I think that the Welsh Government made understandable decisions about cutting their own capacity within the civil service. And again, going back to my previous experience, when I started the job 5 years ago, there were 7 civil servants in charge of youth work in Wales, which is tiny, tiny, tiny. Now there are 2. And their capacity to do anything is very limited. So you can see why the government would make that decision rather than make cuts at the front line, and that's very understandable. And there never, of course, was a politician that won an election by saying we need more and better civil servants. But the truth is that if you don't have them, people get stuck in their silos, they become less able, less flexible, less able to take ideas in from outside. I think the solution to this is perhaps a public service for Wales rather than a civil service, where you have a sort of collegiate system where people can take leadership roles in public service bodies, in local authorities, and because in terms of keeping the best brains, Wales is unlikely just its civil service alone ever to be able to do that. As things stand at the moment, for me, too much of the cross-fertilisation is in and out of Westminster and Whitehall, and what we need is to be growing our capacity and to have more capacity for people from the universities, for example, to be going in and actually doing frontline policy stuff. So Quine goes, let's return to the old days, but let's have more and better use of expertise, but don't let's lose that need for accountability.
Laura, a better... almost revolutionary public service in Wales?
Well, yes, you know, hallelujah to all that. But the issue is how do you do it? I mean, I remember Leighton organising a public services summit, and, you know, I've chaired a Quango, so I know just how difficult it is to actually attract the right quality of people into the leadership team and then actually move them on, you know, get them to do other things. So the two things go hand in hand, actually. If you're serious about improving the cadre of civil servants that we have, we've got to invest in leadership, and that means moving in and out of the sector and accepting these are not jobs for life in the way that they traditionally have been. That's a big, big cultural change if you get, you know, to create a public service. The other thing I think with Quangos, I understand all of the rhetoric that came around the bonfire of the Quangos. It was tied in with all of the power rhetoric of devolution in 97, but we confuse functions with personalities there. We know that some of the Quangos were dominated by individuals who might not have had the best interests of their sector at heart, but you don't remove organisations and their functions because of that. You change them and you get a better class of leader in, and somebody who is putting, sacrificing themselves to the sector rather than expecting the sector to sacrifice itself to them.
Great. I'm a stickler for coming to the end of time, particularly when it comes to broadcasting in particular, so I'm going to finish now. So apologies if you've still got questions. Can I say thank you to Kevin, Laura, Axel, and Helen Mary Jones, and thank you for your questions. Thanks.